turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And I'm going to turn it right back to Chris because we have some follow-ups, and the first one is one from Chris.
Yeah, so 2 weeks ago, I gave a presentation on how I was very unhappy with Digu, and at that meeting, next, I pointed out that their free cloud storage had been reduced from 100 gigabytes to 20 gigabytes, pretty significant reduction. Next. And this actually was there before. You had to sign in every 90 days or your files could get deleted. That wasn't very nice, but that was no change, so that was still there. Next. But to me, one of the biggest problems for me was that free accounts couldn't use a desktop web browser without a workaround that I talked about at that meeting. They did say when you compared the features of the various pay levels and the free, they did actually say that you had access to the web app, but when you tried to use a web app, a web browser, you got this pop-up saying premium required to use Digu on desktop, which I thought was a pretty bad restriction. Next. And so it turns out that all of a sudden, desktop browser is able to be used again. So it looks like that either was a mistake and they've corrected that, or they got enough complaints from people and they restored that. It still is reduced in size from 100 gigabytes to 20 gigabytes, and you still have to sign in every 90 days or else your files can get deleted. But for those who were Digu users or interested in them, and you're okay with just 20 gigabytes of space rather than 100 gigabytes, everything else is back to the way it was. So that's it.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Our next follow-up is dealing with ad blocking. And Jeff had mentioned as part of the session that he found a trick to avoid ads on YouTube. And the trick is to put a dash in the URL after the T in YouTube and before the U. So his example here, the YouTube.com becomes UT-U.com. And apparently that gets rid of the ads. And he also talked about uBlock Origin, and I'd ask whether it gets rid of the ads on YouTube. And in the meantime, he's tried it out, and apparently it does. So if you're running uBlock Origin as a browser extension and you run YouTube videos, then uBlock Origin will actually block the ads for you. And he's using that, Jeff's using that extensively with CBC Gem. So you can watch Gem with a free account without having to go through all the adverts, which is really quite nice. And then the other thing that was mentioned, Bob Walker mentioned this video download helper, which he talked about a while ago at Q&A. And the point there was that if you download the video from YouTube, it doesn't download the adverts. So you can watch it offline without any ads, which is actually quite nice too. So if you're interested in that, there's the reference to Bob's a presentation, and the link for video download helper will be in the deck there, I believe, or you can just look it up. Okay, so moving along, Chris has a computer basics item on that good program Windows.
Yeah, this is all about Windows Spotlight. So it is an option that on the lock screen for Windows 10 and 11, and it actually has pretty neat nature pictures. They're either critters or landscapes, typically. And what happens is the system will automatically download a new picture every day from Bing and display it on the lock screen. And you can see an example there from a few days ago. It's kind of neat. Next. So on the lock screen, there's one other thing about Windows Spotlight, which some people may not be aware of. If you hit the space bar or click the mouse, you'll get prompted for your password, and you put in your password, and Windows logs you on, and you get to your desktop. So that's the normal course of action on it. Next. But if you actually hover the mouse over the text that is in the center of that picture, you get an additional pop-up of a little bit more information. Next. And then if you actually click the mouse on that text, you get prompted for your password, Windows logs you in, you get your desktop, and next. You'll actually get Edge loading with some additional info about the picture on the lock screen. So it'll have photos and stories, and it might have Wikipedia entries for it and things like that. So if you see something that looks kind of cool on the Windows Spotlight on the lock screen and you want more information, make sure that you click on that actual text, and then you'll get that extra information once you've logged in. And that's it. Oh, sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to enable it, if it's not enabled currently, in Windows 10, you go to Settings, Personalization, Lock Screen, and for background, put it to Windows Spotlight rather than Photos or Video. And on Windows 11, slightly different, you go Settings, Personalization, Lock Screen, and the option is Personalize Your Lock Screen. Set that to Windows Spotlight, and also you want to show the lock screen background picture on the signed-in screen, toggle that to be on. And a bonus option on this, if you're on Windows 11, which on one of my computers, I finally am on Windows 11 because it's a new computer and came with Windows 11, you can actually have your desktop wallpaper change daily to a Spotlight picture. And if you actually want that, you go to Settings, Personalization, Background, and under Personalize Your Background, change that to Windows Spotlight, and your desktop wallpaper will rotate daily to a new image from Spotlight. And that's it.
Yeah. Thank Chris and Tom's put a URL in the chat window for a monthly calendar image.
Yeah, there's a number of apps that will change your wallpaper and do various things like that. It's just this is one built right into Windows, and yeah, you can just go with it. And then the image is they are quite good. I mean, if you like nature and landscape photos and that, they're usually very, very good images.
Okay, I have a computer basics item too, which came from a recent operation I was doing where I was actually copying some disk images from an external USB drive to a second similar drive. And the file that I was copying, a disk image, so it's a big file, it's 53 gigabytes, but there was 350 gigabytes of free space on this desktop USB drive. However, the copy failed, and the error message was that the file is too large for the destination file system. And I was wondering why a 53 gigabyte file wouldn't fit into 350 gigabytes of free disk space. And then I remembered that this is an old external USB drive. And first of all, let me just show you that it did actually. I tried doing the copy of this file right here onto this empty space here, and I got this error message, and sure enough, it says too large for the destination file system. And if I look at my file, my file is really 52 gigabytes, and my drive has 350 gigabytes of free space. But what I remembered was that this is an old drive, and if you notice, it's formatted to FAT32, and that's basically the problem. FAT32 has some limitations. The file size can only be up to 4 gigabytes on an up to 2 terabyte volume. So clearly I'm not going to be able to copy a 53 gigabyte file in one shot onto this FAT32 formatted drive. So what I really need to do is convert this to NTFS, because essentially NTFS, although it has some limits, essentially in the real world, the file size and the size of the disk it supports are just absolutely huge. So essentially I say it's unlimited. The neat thing is that Windows has a built-in way of doing this. So you search on the web and you'll find all kinds of web pages that will tell you how to convert the drive from FAT32 to NTFS. And it's basically running this Windows Convert utility program. And the format is basically convert the drive to file system colon NTFS. So when you do that, you pick up a Windows command window. I want to convert my E drive / FS core NTFS. And when I run that, then it tells me that the file is about 32. And then the next thing it does is it goes and does a checklist. So it makes sure that the system, the disk is in good shape. So it checks all that stuff. And then it does the conversion routine. So now it's changing the format from FAT32 to NTFS. And so it goes through all that process and basically it says conversion complete. So now when I go and look at my disk drive again, now that same drive has 370 gig of free space, but now it's formatted as NTFS. And the neat thing about this is that the convert program will do the conversion without losing any data. So you don't have to copy the existing files anywhere and then write them back later on. Now you can just do the conversion in place and it works basically perfectly. So now when I call up my I call up my file from my OneDrive, my external drive, I don't use OneDrive, my first external drive, copy it to the second external drive, you see that now the copy is proceeding as it should have done. So if you run into that problem that you need to have NTFS on a drive rather than FAT32, then convert is actually a neat way to make the change. Okay, and Tom is noting that NTFS is safer because it's a journaling file system, so it keeps track of what's going on, basically. And Chris notes that it's more efficient. Is that because it's using a different sector size?
Yeah, the cluster size is 4K, whereas on large volumes on FAT32, I forget what they get up to, but they're huge, like 64K cluster sizes. So you will waste, on average, half a cluster per file. So it adds up pretty quick.
Yeah. Okay. So Chris needs a computer basics night tonight. Chris has another computer basics item.
Not only a good one as a computer basic, but a reminder for those of us that are, shall we say, better versed than average. Don't get tricked when you're installing software. So I was installing Opera in order to have it available to do testing and comparisons and things like that. And so I asked, you know, the question, is Opera browser respected? I think yes. Is it trustworthy? Yes. And I downloaded it from the Opera website. So, you know, surely this can all be trusted. Next. So they wouldn't try to trick me or anything like that when I'm installing their software, would they? Next. So I should probably just click on accept and install, right? Next. So what would have happened if I had clicked accept and install? So I actually went to the options screen on this, which comes up with what would have happened had I just clicked on the accept and install. So the first thing I noticed is that it installs only for the current user, which is odd. I mean, it's neither good nor bad as far as I'm concerned. Most software installs for all users on the computer. So if you have multiple users, you know, anybody else who uses that computer can use the software as well. So it's kind of a little bit odd that it will be installed for just current user. And it could be rather wasteful if everybody, you say you have five users and everybody wants to use Opera and they just install it as a default, you'll have five copies of Opera installed on your hard drive. Kind of wasteful. Next. Then it comes into a little bit other stuff that, I don't know. First off, make Opera the default browser. Now, every browser thinks that they're the best thing since sliced bread, and you should use it as a default browser. So in a way, I can excuse Opera for also doing this, and it's relatively simple to undo that and set some other browser as your default browser. But just because I'm installing Opera or any browser doesn't mean I want it to be the default browser. Next. Then you have, help improve Opera by sending, information to them about how you use the browser. A lot of software wants to do that. And there's not necessarily a bad thing, but in an area, an era of sensitivity about data, they're not very clear about what it is they're actually going to be sending. If they are sending URLs of where you visit, I definitely don't want to give that information to Opera. If it is just how long I use it and, some other things like that, maybe okay, but, I don't know about having that as a default. Next. And then the last one, if it was my default browser, I might actually want it to load in the background when the computer starts up so that when I go to the browser, it'll come up faster. But if I'm not using it as my default browser, do I want it actually loading in the background and sitting around in the background all the time while I'm using my other browser? So, I typically would not want that. Next. So the bottom line for me, for Opera at least, now it's not malicious. I don't believe that anybody could make a credible case for it being malicious. There's no real fear of getting malware installed on your computer when you install Opera, as long as you get it from Opera website and not from some shady third party or something like that. But the key thing is that what they choose as the defaults might not match what you want or what you expect to happen when that software is actually installed. So for me, it was definitely worth checking that options, which you notice it's just a pale gray as opposed to the big bright blue button to accept and install. Look for those options. And when I went into that, I deselected those two that I show on there about making it my default browser because it definitely isn't my default browser and to run on startup. I don't want it to run on startup. Next. Actually, there was one. I actually did change it to install for all users, by the way, as well. But that not really a big deal. I'm only user on this computer. So how much will this protect you to actually go in and check those options when you're doing an install? So will clicking on options or custom install or something like that, will it protect you from any malware getting onto your computer because of a software installation? No. So if the author of the software is a hacker, okay, and they have malicious intent, they're not going to ask you permission. They're not going to allow you to deselect anything that they want to install or change on your computer. So it's not a catch-all for, being able to protect against everything. However, next. Will it actually give you some kind of protection? Can it help you other ways? And absolutely. So it can allow you to avoid changes such as, in a browser, default homepage might be changed. Default search engine could be changed. You could get toolbars up the yin-yang that the, they're getting paid to actually foist toolbars on you. And this can be other software as well that will decide to go into your default browser, change your homepage and your search engine, give you toolbars and things like that, additional extensions that they may make money off of or who knows what, any other companion software that could get installed alongside of the software that you actually decided that you wanted, and lots more. So next. So the bottom line, during any software installation, always look for that options or custom installation, something like that, and click on that. And they will always come up with what the defaults are if you would just bypass that and say, go ahead and install. But it gives you that option to turn off any of those customizations that maybe you don't want. That's it.
Chris, Glenn has a question. How do you verify that the software is from a legitimate site?
If it's software like well-known, like Opera, or Firefox or something like that, it's usually pretty simple. If you don't know whether it's .com or .org or whatever, if you Google for it, it'll be high on the list. You can also check the certificate once you get there, because everybody worth their salt on the web now is going to have a certificate on the web browsing, so it's a secure session. You can check the certificate to make sure that it seems to jive with the company, that it's the right place. If it's some other software, like you just heard about or found out about some utility that does some neat kind of thing and you want to verify if they're a legitimate organization or whatever, it gets more difficult. You can check with places like the Ottawa PC User Group, you know, and say, has anybody got any opinions on this? You can also Google for, say you have a, you know, a XYZ widget, and you could do a search for XYZ widget malware or review or various things like that. And don't look at just the first hit that you get, but look at it and see if there are anybody that's complaining about, yeah, I installed that, my computer went haywire, or yeah, it's known malware, or it's really good software. You know, you can get those sort of things from a number of people that will voice their opinion on the web. So that, generally speaking, is my best advice for trying to make sure whether something is legitimate or not.
The other thing you can do is, rather than just opening the program and installing it, is to download the file and then maybe submit it to VirusTotal and see, make sure it's legitimate that way.
Yeah, that's true. I do that almost all the time, even from legitimate sources like Opera. When I downloaded that, I actually just automatically submit everything to VirusTotal and make sure that it comes up as clean on there.
The other question I had was this business of installing for multiple users. I've noticed that on quite a few programs, recently. I've never quite understood the rationale for that. In my situation, I'm the only user, so I'm not really concerned, but I generally run Windows as a regular user, and I have an admin account. So I guess I've always done it as all users because I want to be able to use the same software if I'm running as the admin. And but I don't know whether that's what they mean by all users.
Well, that is, because otherwise it installs it underneath your profile where nobody else, even an administrator, doesn't have access to.
Okay. All right. So if it's all users, then I should keep going with all users.
Yeah, I if anybody else has an idea why you would want to install something under a single user, I'd be curious about how come, because I don't see a benefit for it, really.
Tristan's saying that maybe it's due to corporate environments where they don't allow admin access. So Windows programs are generally installing as a user.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So if you're not an administrator on the computer, yeah, you have to install it under just your own user ID. Yeah.
And Tristan says admin access is required to install for all users.
Yeah. Yep.
Stuart thinks it might be parental controls.
Could be, I suppose, but even under parental controls, from the perspective of, do you want your kid messing up your computer? If they mess up their profile as opposed to other parts of the computer, that might help. I don't know. Oh, adult material. You want them to install adult material where you're not going to be able to find it?
So Tim had mentioned a site here, which I just came across recently too, TOSDR. What is it? It's Terms of Service That I Did Not Read. Yes, TOSDR.org. And basically it gives you the kind of the highlights of the terms of service for a number of different programs. Because most people will just say agree and off you go. So it's kind of an interesting read if you want to check that out.
Yeah, Stu also mentions, isn't Softpedia some sort of reference? Yeah, there are some sites out there like Softpedia. There's a few others. I can't think of any of the names off the top of my head. I generally don't bother going there. I'll go to the source. But they're sort of aggregators of all kinds of software that you can download from them. And I will mention something a little later on tonight about one use of them. There are some, and they do some vetting on software. I'm not sure I necessarily trust them to vet stuff. I would still send it through VirusTotal, things like that. But it might be a little bit better than just a random website out there, for sure. Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So I've got a thing next, which basically follows up from what I think was Stuart suggested last week, kind of reviews of things that we've done previously. So I've called it Software Update. And the one I want to talk about first is Software Data Cable, which is actually an Android app. And I use it for transferring files between my phone and my PC. Now, because I don't like having to find the cable to plug the phone into the computer. And this basically works over Wi-Fi and produces an FTP connection. And so you really need two pieces of software to run this thing. Software data cable to make the connection and an FTP client, and I use FileZilla, to actually do the file transfer. And I've had this program for quite a few years now. I find it works really well. So basically you call up software data cable on the phone and tell it to make the connection, and it basically gives you an FTP address. So what you do next is you go to your FTP client and you make the connection to this FTP address, and then it brings up the main window here, which has got two windows. So on this side, we're looking at the computer, the PC, and on this side, we're looking at the smartphone. So we basically navigate to the folder where our files are that we want. We highlight the ones we want, and then we click and drag and drop them from the phone to the computer, and the files are basically automatically transferred. So it's a really an easy process once you've done it once or twice, but it works extremely well, and you don't have to go looking for the cable. You can just use your Wi-Fi system at home. Okay, and then the next one I've got is LibreOffice. This is essentially a clone. I don't like the word clone because it just kind of reproduces a lot of the features of Microsoft Office. So as you see here, there's a suite of programs. So LibreOffice has Writer, which is like Microsoft Word. It has Calc, which is like Excel, Impress, which is PowerPoint, Base, which is like Access, it's a database program, and the additional one that LibreOffice has is called Draw. So this is LibreOffice Writer we're talking about, and I like this suite because it's free, it's open source, which is always a good thing in my book, and it also has macro programming capability. And they use LibreOffice Basic, which is very much like Visual Basic for applications, which MS Office uses. And in fact, LibreOffice is trying to make LibreOffice Basic compatible with VBA. So if you've used Excel and macro programming, you can probably get along with LibreOffice as well. So you can see here an example of a document. This is actually the index to the Q&A sessions that we're doing tonight. And you can see it's basically a Word type document. It's got pictures and bold text and links and all that kind of good stuff. And it also has a macro here so I can add entries, with a click of the button. However, it turns out that Writer has a little problem. And the problem is when you have big files. And I noticed this because if you followed the article that Chris and I wrote on setting up a new computer, we recommended that you set up a maintenance log and you keep track of software that you've installed and configuration changes that you've made and backups that you have stored away somewhere in this ongoing log file. Now, I've been running these log files for years and they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And what happens is I always leave it. I enter my most recent change. So I'm at the end of the file. I save the file. And then when I open it, I find I'm in the middle of the file somewhere. And this didn't used to happen in the good old days, but recent updates to Writer has created a bug. So you can see, I'll show you the problem right here. Here's a Project Gutenberg open source book, and it's a truth universally acknowledged of a single man in possession of good fortune. You probably recognize this as Jane Austen and Pride and Prejudice. And if I go to the end of the file here, you notice that the cursor is sitting after the end, and we're on page 235 of 235 pages. So now I'm going to save using the icon up here. I'm going to save the file and close it. And then when I open it, you find that the cursor is in the middle of the sentence here, and it's on page 192 of 235 pages. So it forgot where the cursor was when this file was last used. And that's actually a bug. So I submitted this to Bugzilla, which is the LibreOffice bug reporting system. And it turns out all kinds of people have been having this problem for quite a while. This is what, February the 6th. Last I saw, this was supposed to be fixed in 7.5, and it's not. And it's also not fixed in 7.5.3, which is the latest release of LibreOffice. Fortunately, before they get around to fixing it, there's a really easy solution. You open the file, you're in the wrong place, you just hit Control N, and it jumps right to the end of the file. So if this was my maintenance log, I'd now be in the right place to enter my next entry. So LibreOffice works really well, except when it has a bug, and one of these days they'll get around to fixing it. Okay, anything?
We have one thing going back a little bit. Jeff was asking about the WireSync program. Does it always use the same private IP address for the specific device? Does it change each time you plug in the device, but you don't actually plug in the device? So does it always come up with the same IP address?
Yeah, usually it does.
Okay.
But I haven't seen it change as well. But normally, if I plug the phone into the same computer, I can make the connection instantly. I don't have to change the FTP address.
Okay, Bill comments that WPS Office is another clone for Android found on Play Store, and Tom says ostensibly. I've played around a little bit with WP Office, and it's kind of weird.
Okay. I see Bob here says LibreOffice doesn't update automatically. You have to check. And it will tell you that there's an update available, but yeah, I think you do have to download them manually. I don't know if you can set it to check automatically. Okay, moving along, it's that time of year, and Chris has got a share for us.
Yeah, over the years, I've used TurboTax and Ufile, which I think Ufile is now owned by TurboTax, not sure. Most recently, over the last about 3 years, I guess, I used H&R Block software to do my taxes, and I basically moved from one program to another as they started charging on one, and I found another one that wouldn't. And so to avoid paying for software to do my taxes, I just moved from program to program. Now, I found with H&R Block, and probably any of the other free ones that have commercial versions as well, you have to be pretty careful. They try to trick you into selecting a paid version, which is usually about $20, rather than sticking with the free version. And they're pretty good about doing this. They hide the options for free. They try to make it sound like you have to select the paid version, or they try to tell you that there's wonderful things you can get with the paid version that you don't get with the free, and so forth. But I always found that it was possible to stick with the free version. Next. So after diligently avoiding the traps leading to the paid version this year, I went through most of the steps. One of the things you don't get with the free version is it doesn't carry through information from previous years. So things like your name, your address, and all of those boilerplate type pieces of information, you have to enter them in manually, and that's fine. I entered that in. I downloaded the slips from CRA through the program. That was fine, and I was checking them, doing a few other things until... And next, all of a sudden I got this screen, and it said, to file certain items you reported, you need to upgrade. And you can see I was on the one on the left, H&R Block Free, and they wanted me to upgrade to H&R Block Deluxe at $20. And next, and it tells you what it is that is not included in the free. And it is information not covered by H&R Block Free, statement of investment income. Now, that actually can go down as far as being a T5, bank interest that you get. And I would be willing to bet that the majority of the people out there have at least one T5 slip. And if you have even one T5 slip, you now cannot use H&R Block Free. Next. And I thought, I don't think so, folks. So I went looking. So Google to the rescue. I Googled for CRA-approved tax software 2023. And I got a URL, and I'll paste that into the chat right now. And if you go to that page, one of the sections on it will say find free or pay what you want tax software. And if you click on where it says free products and products with pay what you want model, if you click on that, next, you'll get a screen of a whole bunch of software that is available out there that is ostensibly that. Next. First thing I did was I eliminated all the ones that said they were mobile apps. I don't want to do my taxes on my phone. Next. And I eliminated TurboTax Free for Windows because I went on their website and I looked and I looked and I looked and I could not find TurboTax Free for Windows. There is no free option for the desktop that I could find, and even the link at the CRA site brought me to an area where basically they just wanted to charge me money. And the online free option, there is one very similar to the H&R Block, but it as well doesn't allow for T5 slips. So that's why I eliminated that. Next. So that left me with basically four that were listed as online and one listed for desktop. I more or less randomly chose Wealth Simple Tax. Next. And it is wonderful. Very, very easy to use. I found it less confusing than H&R Block. H&R Block, you were always on these one screen, jumping to another screen. And, you know, if you wanted to go back and check something, you had to, you know, go and find the option to go back to a different section and things like that. Wealth Simple Tax has one long page, and you just go from the top and you scroll down through the bottom, filling out what you need. It's all got all the automation stuff built into it, just like H&R Block does, but it flowed a lot better, and their language I found was a lot better. It had everything. So it can download the slips from CRA automatically. If you have a CRA My account, you can, right from within the program, you can say, I want to get my T5 and T4 slips and all the rest of them from CRA. It'll log you in there, download them, fill out the forms automatically, handle all the slips that I have, including all my T5s. So there was no problem with that. And the layout was great, and it just works. Next. So back in the other list that I had there, there was one that said it had desktop software. And so there was only one free one listed at the CRA site for downloadable software, and some may prefer this. So very much so if you have concerns about your tax information being stored on some third-party web server, then you might want to download software and just keep it all local on your computer. It's listed as donationware, so basically it's if you're happy with it, you give them whatever money you feel it's worth. I found it asked a ton more questions of Wealth Simple Tax. Now, that might be a benefit in some circumstances. It wasn't for me, but it'll ask you things like, are you a farmer? And, there's all kinds of extra questions that I never saw in the Wealth Simple Tax. Well, if I was a farmer, then maybe Wealth Simple Tax would have missed some stuff. But for me, it actually covered everything I needed. But I did download the software. I ran it. I came up with exactly the same results as Wealth Simple Tax, which gives me good assurance that when I go ahead and do my filing, that it should be all correct and I'll get the proper money back from CRA.
Okay, so Tom notes that he's happy with Studio Tax. It's a pay program, $15 for 20 returns. Which is a local Ottawa company. B has been using GenuTax for years and it seems good. Tim thinks that TurboTax is free for US taxes, and that's useful. And El Boulay says, I've been using Wealthsimple for the last 3 years. And Tristan says, if you have a CRA online account, don't forget to use AutoFill.
Yeah, that's that thing where I mentioned that it could download the data direct from there. Tom also sent a message to me, and I'll just highlight it. It says the tax year is 2022, not 2023. The URL was actually it's one of those things that Google automatically popped up with things as you type things in, and so when I said CRA approved tax, we came up with that. I'm presuming they were saying that software that is available in 2023 to do 2022 taxes. So yeah.
And Bill's asking, when you fill out these forms, how do you actually submit them?
You can submit it from right within the program. All of the programs the CRA lists there allow you to file electronically.
Okay. I'm just trying to go through this stuff here. Stuart says he uses the local community volunteer center.
Yeah, that's probably not a bad idea. I mean, if you, they might prompt you to for other things that you don't think of. I have that deduction available to me as well. So
especially because Stu looks like a farmer.
And Greg says one situation which isn't always handled well is for Quebec residents working in Ontario.
Oh, interesting.
So if you're in that situation, I guess you've got to be a bit careful too.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Something for everybody to think about.
Oh, okay. And there's, I covered that slide. That's it for me then. Yep.
Okay. So the next thing we have is Jeff Dubois, who has an item on a Windows utility for dealing with tiles on the start menu. So, Jeff, you're going to unmute your mic and share your screen.
Okay. We're unmuted.
Mic's good.
Yeah, I'm just looking for the share screen app.
There's a big green icon at the bottom of the screen.
On the toolbar.
I see polls, chat. Oh, yeah, there we go. Share screen. That just popped up.
Oh, yeah. Then you have to choose which screen you want to share, and then you have to tell it to share.
So I'm presuming I want to share that one, and then I have to share that one.
That's good.
We should be there.
So we've got your desktop.
Oh, yeah. There I am there. Okay, so we're going to be talking about Tile Iconifier, which is a third-party application. As you can probably see, my Windows start screen. What Tile Iconifier does is it allows you to create custom Windows tiles on the start screen. You can see here on the Microsoft Office Suite, this is the standard. I haven't iconified this one. this is what Microsoft installs. I find them very small, very ugly, they're not really eye catching. I find them hard to see actually, because, you know, as most of you know, I have a visual impairment. So I have iconified the rest of these and all of these. The beauty about this is that it's not just your apps that you can iconify. You can iconify, you can create a custom tile for virtually anything. LibreOffice, for example, these were the standards. I created this one today just to, you know, that's the standard icon tile for base. That's the one I created. But you can create your own. What I like is you can call any file as well. So, for example, this is a PPS, a PowerPoint slide, which would have been the last one that Alan showed you. So how did I find this? Well, I went to ChatGPT and I said, what programs can I use to make custom tiles? And it came back and it said Obli Tile, and it said Tile Iconifier. The mistake I made on ChatGPT is I didn't say for Windows 10. Obli Tile was a great custom tile maker for 8.1, but it doesn't work on 10. I wanted to know, okay, well, so I asked ChatGPT, where do I get it? It said, well, there's the link. So I went and got it and I installed it and I like it. So I'm going to actually show you how it works. So let me try to iconify something here. So I'm going to call it up. I keep some apps in a utilities directory. It's a simple executable. We're going to call it up. I'm going to close that. Now it will load with a screen that, takes a minute to load. Just let me pull it down so it doesn't want to pull down for me. So I'm on the access one, for example. If I double click, this would be the access icon. And what I can do is I can, you know, zoom in and out with my mouse button, and I can control it. The size, I can move it around. I could, you know, put it wherever I want. I believe I told my tile icons for Windows. That's probably about the same size. I think I told them to use kind of a reddish, I believe I said 80. Might have been what I told it. So I'm going to just change that to 80. I'm guessing here. And then I say tile iconify. So when I go back to my start menu, and there it is. And we can see that it's now the same. If I wanted to, like, for example, let's say I want to put a computer link as a tile, like to a website. When I'm at the cottage, this is the laptop I take to the cottage, but I like to know, when I check my mail, I don't want to close a browser, minimize, click on favorite, click on this, click on that. I like stuff a little quicker. So this would be the link to Environment Canada 7-day. I'm just going to copy that. And now there's a menu bar in front of my screen, so we can't get to it easily for some reason. Let's see if I, there, that's better. My menu bar was on top, so it was hard to get to. I'll create a custom tile. I want to create a new one. And again, it's going to take a while to load. You can see here whether you want to do something in Explorer, a Steam game, Chrome apps, a Windows Store app, a UIL, or something else. You could call a video up and have a tile for that. And that's can be really important. It's still loading here. I guess it has to look at all the, so there we go. So I'm going to say a URL, and the URL target is the that website. I'm just going to call it the 7-day forecast. I'm going to choose an icon. Oh, that's hard to get to. Let me get this down so I can. I'm going to take, I happen to use OneDrive. I've got a bunch of pictures that I regularly use. This is what I used to do with the Metro tiles on Windows 8. I should have one for weather. There you are there. There's the weather. And then I'm going to say, okay. It should have created it. I believe it did. So let me say, go to selected icon. It's probably the top one, wouldn't it be? Wait, what did I do wrong here? Don't you just hate when that happens? I thought I said go to. Why don't I see it there?
I think you might have missed generate shortcut button.
Oh, I probably did, yeah. That's yeah, that's probably exactly what I did. Okay, well, sorry about that. Create URL. Yeah, I might have missed the button.
It's in the bottom right of that window.
Yeah, I probably did. I'll just say 7-day. Oops. 7-day. I'm going with a magnification here because I thought if I put the voice on, it would be very distracting for everybody if I had a screen reader screaming in the background. Image files, W for weather, there you are, 7-day. Where am I? Generate? No, it must
be
on
okay,
the next.
There now, yeah.
And then generate. Yeah, that's what I missed was there. Yeah, that would be it. Generate. Then you have to close the screen, which is kind of a. My menu bar for the Zoom is on top, so it's a little distracting. 7-day, and there it is over here. You can go to. And I'll make that a little, let's just go with a black background for simplicity. And I will go tile iconify. Now, because it's a custom file, you're going to see it in the start menu under tile iconify. It has a folder. And I can go there and I can go pin to start. And there you are down there, which I'm going to drag it up top. Come on, keep going. It can be real tricky on the start menu, but anyway, there it is there. Now, the beauty about what I really like about having things on the start menu is, and this used to happen when you're giving a PowerPoint presentation, if you have to stop to show, a video or whatever, it doesn't really matter what it is. If I call up this, this was the PowerPoint thing. If I wanted to show a video or go to a website, if I wasn't using something off the start menu, which I can access quickly, if I wanted the weather, it's just, you know, I would hit it and it would load. There's the 7-day forecast. I guess I have a slow connection, so, and there would be the 7-day, but you could tie that and then you just Alt F4 to close it. When you're giving a presentation, a slideshow presentation, you could have a start menu to a video. You could just click once on it. It would load Alt F4 and you're right back into your slideshow. You don't have to hit play so it becomes very seamless. It's not distracting. You don't have to look for things and oh, it's in this directory or that directory. I really like it. It's really makes everything visible, makes it, and it's customizable. So that pretty much sums it up. I think it's some people might, you know, it depends on the individual. Maybe you're happy with, maybe people are happy with the, you know, the basic windows. I like something that's a little easier to see and a little more seamless. And when I'm doing a presentation, I'll create an entire group and I will place it very, you know, so I could have, oh, there's an audio file or a website and everything's just one, you know, hit the Windows key, click once, and you're showing whatever, and then you're right back into your slideshow.
I also noticed that your background, you've used the background of your images to categorize different programs, like all your Office 365 are up there with the dark red background.
Yeah. This is the office. This is my office suite here, and this is the Office 365 online. Often I will use various PDF programs as well tied into the office. This is a down and dirty speech synthesizer program I use. So I keep it right handy and my browsers are all there. If I have internet problems, check all my media streaming. So I keep things for me, it's very easy to find. And I also like to, I mean, I could make the start menu, you know, you could go full screen if I wanted, but I like to be able to see. Sometimes I keep a quick note file down here so I can, when I'm not in a slideshow, for example, I have a quick note text file that I can easily access, right there. So yeah, but anyway, that's Tile Iconify. It's free. It works. I have found one bug in it, and I actually sent the bug report today. When I was doing this thing and showing that you could call up a slideshow, it was in a directory called Q&A, and I was getting an error message. I think it's because the ampersand was in the directory name, and I think the program had a hard time. I took it out and it worked fine. So I went on to GitHub and sent the developer a note saying, I don't know if that's what it is, but here's the error message that you requested to please, if you notice. And I said, it might be related to this, but I haven't checked back in to see if, but yeah, that was the only thing anyway, that's it. That's Tile Iconify.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks very much, Jeff. It's, really quite nice. People will be able to play with that. Now, Tristan's put a link in the chat here for icons for various open source products. It's a GitHub site, so if you're looking for specific icons, they might be there. Okay, moving along, we had a question came in about Google Chrome.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting. B sent this in, and she has a friend who has a Windows 7 computer still on the network. And this morning, the Chrome browser would not open. And so she was asking, is Chrome no longer supported on Windows 7, and is there a workaround? Next. So I went on, and I checked out the Googled for Chrome system requirements, and it says to use Chrome browser on Windows, you need Windows 10 or later, or Windows Server 2016 or later. And then there was a box below that, and part of it showed OS version Windows 7, and it said Chrome deprecation release and date. So it is no longer supported beyond Chrome 109. Chrome 109 was released January 10th. Of 2023, and they make a note that the end of life of Windows 7 was actually over 3 years ago, and so they've made that decision. And the URL is there, and I will paste that into the chat as well. So that was the first part of it is basically, yes, it's no longer supported. So Chrome does automatic updates. And as soon as it tried to do an update, I guess it either wiped out the old one or something. But basically, you don't have a working Chrome anymore. Next. So the option could be to roll back to Chrome 109. And so basically you would uninstall Chrome, install version 109. Now Google says flat out they don't make old versions available. They update for a reason. They don't want people installing older versions. There are other file repositories that do have older versions of software available, and this has not been tested by me, but if you go to that URL, there's talk there about how to downgrade to older versions of Chrome. Now, the problem is going to be that Chrome is going to try to auto-update as soon as you get the older version on. There are ways to prevent that. And I'm not going to get into how to do that. And there are various methods, including stopping a service, including manual editing of the registry. And I'm not about to vet whether any of those actually work or not. Next. So should you actually roll back to Chrome 109? So the short answer, I think, is no. Browsers are absolutely notorious to having bugs. And because this is something that is you're inherently online and you could be connecting to nefarious servers out there, you don't want to be using something that is bugs. So attackers, I think, right now are probably going to start targeting Windows 7 users that are using the last supported version of Chrome. They can find out what are the bugs that were fixed in going beyond version 109, and they can develop a website that would actively attack your computer. Next. So I think it's better to use a supported browser, and I looked today, and there are at least three that still support Windows 7. There's Opera, Firefox, and Vivaldi. But, they're likely to actually stop supporting Windows 7 at some point as well. Personally, I think that this is time. This is one of the cases where using an unsupported version of the operating system can bite you. My advice would be very strongly to get that computer onto a supported Windows version, which then will be supported by other software, including the web browser and things like that. If anybody actually has anything to add to that, I'm more than happy to listen to it, but that's my bottom line, is that's why, one of the reasons why you should be using a supported version of the operating system.
Firefox is not a Chromium-based operating system, for that matter, no, neither is Safari. So
no, but if you are on a supported version of Windows, you would be able to use Chrome or Opera or Firefox or Vivaldi if you were on a supported version of Windows. It's only because it's an older version of Windows that Microsoft stopped supporting 3 years ago that now the application vendors are starting to drop support for it. And I fully expect that Opera, Firefox, and Vivaldi are going to, at some point, probably in the not-too-distant future, say that they are not supporting Windows 7.
So we should upgrade to Linux.
Sure.
Absolutely, we should. I think the major, bigger problem is running Windows 7, you're sitting duck for security issues.
Yeah. And the security issues are now permeating into the applications that you can actually run on that version of the operating system that has security vulnerabilities. So the situation is just getting worse and worse.
Yeah, I mean, I think Windows 7 is fine, but I'm not sure I wouldn't be using it online.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Chris. We're in the last 10, but we're over the last 10, so I'm going to skip the any other questions. But I will point out, if there's any new people here tonight that are not members of the club, we have a special offer. So if you join the club before March 31st, you will become a member in good standing, and the board has decided that all members in good standing on March the 31st will have their membership renewed for free. So this is basically a two-for-one type deal. If you're joining right now, you're going to get 2 years for the price of one. Next week, there will be no Q&A because it's our regular monthly meeting. And the speakers are Paul and Maria from the Trailing Edge. They were here previously talking about different computers. This time they're going to be talking about repair issues and tales from the computer workbench. So that should be quite interesting to see what kind of problems they get into their store, and how easy some of these things are to fix. So as I said earlier, because it's a regular meeting, we don't have a Q&A. So our next Q&A will be on the 15th, which means that you have 2 whole weeks to get your questions together and the presentations that you want to share with the group. And then we'll be back at Q&A on March the 15th. So otherwise, we've had a lot of different topics tonight. So hope everybody enjoyed it. And that's it for me.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week at the general meeting.
That you were talking about the person with Chrome?
Yep.
That wouldn't update. I noticed an article on ZDNet by Ed Bott that the Windows update system, although Microsoft isn't advertising it, that they're still updating free of charge any legitimate copies.
Yeah.
So if they're a fully activated copy of Windows 7, it could be updated free of charge to 10 and keep all the files. Would depend if the system, of course, had enough oomph to do it. But if it met the specs, probably I would say, they say 2 gigabytes. I think about 8 would be better with 10, but you can certainly keep all the files and programs, and most of them would probably be compatible, and in which case Chrome would update.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I find that for the most part, if it runs Windows 7 well, it will probably run Windows 10 okay.
Yeah.
Certainly they're not going to be able to get it to Windows 11, but that does get you a couple of more years until Windows 10 is end of life. So that would definitely be a good option to consider, just upgrading the operating system for free.
With the sheer number of systems that are running Windows, that are currently running Windows 10, that are probably only about 5-6 years old, because some of the low-end machines were still being sold not that long ago, but they're not capable of running Windows 10. Has there been any scuttlebutt about Microsoft extending the life cycle on 10?
I have not heard anything myself on that. I suspect that they would not advertise that until very close to the current end of life, because they want pressure on people to go ahead and do the update, to buy new hardware, and just go right to 11. They really don't want people going to Windows 10. So I suspect that any extensions that come about are going to be last-minute decisions or last-minute announcements.
Yeah, there's still an awful pile of machines that there's a lot. I wonder if there's still – you might actually find one in a maybe not. Is there anything you'd find in a store now that's not 11 compatible?
Not 11 compatible? Yeah. There's still older stuff that is around there now. It's getting pretty rare. You're more likely to run into it in a place like the Trailing Edge or something like that is selling refurbished computers. You'll find them there for sure. But if you look at the like Best Buy, you'll find some of their computers that they're selling. Now they might be third party, I'm not sure, but I've seen ones on there that are not at Windows 11. They're still Windows 10.
Yeah, that's what I figured. Yeah.
And being sold as new machines. So.
Yeah, and 2 years 2 years is not a lot of life cycle. Anyway, food for thought on the upgrade and Chrome.
Yeah, I should have put that on the slide, actually. That was a good point, and I'll pass that on to Bea. I think she's off the call now, so I will pass that along to her. So when she's talking to the friend who had the Windows 7 machine, she can pass on that idea of just doing an upgrade to Windows 10.
I'll find the article by Ed Bott, and I'll fire it over to you.
Okay, that'd be great. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, good night, folks.
Good night.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, Chris. Where do you get your Dilbert comics?
Oh, I get the Daily Dilbert in email. But you can go to dilbert.com and get them.
Okay, because I used to see them in, I think it might have been Comics Kingdom or Arc Max Publishing, but okay. Dilbert's been removed.
Oh, okay. I wonder, is that just in the last couple of days?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he went on a rant that was sort of racist, and he was saying that white people should avoid black people, things like that. So yeah. he's been dropped from some publications and so forth. But as far as I know, Dilbert.com still exists, and so you can always get them from there.
Yeah, it's been dropped from the Ottawa Citizen.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
I was really surprised when I heard that Scott Adams had actually said that. I thought, you know, you've got to be insane. I mean, it's one thing to think it. It's another thing to be stupid enough to actually say it publicly.
Yeah, but he did say in the report that he'll probably be very low on business now.
Yeah.
Most of his money was coming from the comics.
Oh, okay. Wow. Oh, good luck on him.
Yep. Have a good one.
You too. Night, folks.
Leave.